Well, I call your attention tonight to the Old Testament, 2 Samuel, and we'll be in chapter 10 this evening. The writer of Samuel, and when I say that, I'm referring to 2 Samuel. I believe that probably the prophet Samuel probably wrote the majority of 1 Samuel. I'm not sure who wrote 2 Samuel. I don't know if anybody else can be dogmatic on it. But it seems as though that the writer in chapter 9 and now tonight in chapter 10 is wanting to show us a side of David that's a beautiful side. If you looked at the beginning of chapter 9 last week, you see in verse number 1 that David is trying to find somebody that's left of the house of Saul that he can show a kindness to. That same word, it's a Hebrew word called heshesh. That same word is used in chapter 10. And in our passage tonight, what we see is that there is a man named Nahash that has died. And so it says that David is wanting to show a kindness to his son. And so I think that he's showing that David has a side that is very, very commendable. The title of the message tonight is Kindness Rejected. And I think that you have probably experienced that before in your life. I hope you have not administered that type of behavior. But often God's people, their motives are impugned. And so this evening, I've simply divided this chapter into three easy points. Now, starting most likely next week or whenever I preach on Samuel again, we'll probably begin to slow down. It seems as though the last several weeks that I've been taking a whole chapter at one time. Tonight, we'll take a whole chapter. Last week, I took a whole chapter. It seems as the way that the chapters are beginning to break down, it's going to slow down just a little bit, because when we get to chapter 11 and chapter 12, you're going to see a side of David that's ugly. We see tonight, we see a good side. But the next time, you're going to see a side that all of us have. David, even though he was a man after God's own heart, he had a sin nature just as we do. And if you doubt that, you don't observe very much. In this big, wide, whole world of 7 billion plus people, the one that I have the most trouble with is the guy that I look in the mirror every morning as I'm brushing my teeth. That's the one that I have the most trouble with. And so David, he's the same way. He has sin in his life because of a sin nature. And so tonight, though, we're not going to see David at his worst. We're going to see David at one of his best moments. I really think that chapter 9 was probably the best moment in David's life as far as the compassion, the kindness, the love, and he tries to extend that. If you notice chapter 9, you'll see that he is giving that compassion, that kindness, that love, he's giving it to one of God's people. He's giving it to someone within the boundaries of the nation of Israel. But tonight, what we're going to see is that he's trying to extend that to someone outside the boundaries of Israel. And there's a reason for that. So tonight, there's three little easy points tonight that we'll go through. And if you're taking notes, it's just simply this. Number one, we see sympathy. Number two, we see slander. And number three, we see slaughter. You see those three things in these 19 verses tonight. The first thing I want us to do is I want us to pick up in chapter 10, verse number 1. And it came to pass after this, after what? After the story of Mephibosheth, that the king of the children of Ammon died, and Hanan, his son, reigned in his stead. So you've got a man that dies. We know who that is. It's seen in verse number 2. Then said David, I will show kindness. I will show hishesh unto Hanan, the son of Nahash, as his father showed kindness unto me. Now, you say, where did this Ammonite show kindness to David? I don't know if we can point to a specific place in the earlier years of David. Possibly when the men of Jabesh-Gilead were coming after David. You remember those men were loyal to Saul. That David received help from outside of Israel, and possibly that's what he's making a reference to. Nobody knows that for sure. But you've got a kindness that was somehow bestowed upon David, and when he hears about Nahash dying, he thinks, I want to try to do something that'll be kind and nice to his son. And so, what does David do? We see that he sends of himself, he sends his servants for his father's sake, Nahash's sake. And David's servants came into the land of the children of Ammon. So what you've got is you've got kindness being a part of David's DNA. We see it. It seems as though that there's something that is tender. I talked last time about man of steel, man of velvet. And it seems as though that right now we're seeing the soft side of King David. In just a few verses, we're going to see a harder side of King David. But it's not something that he initiates. It's something that he reacts to. And so we see a sympathy that he has extended. I think that you and I can remember times when people have misunderstood us. Is that not what it says? I think it's over in Hebrews chapter 11. Matter of fact, why don't we flip over there right quick? Go to Hebrews chapter 11, and I want you to look with me. I think it's somewhere around verse 36, 37, somewhere in there. Let's see if that's what I'm remembering right. Hebrews 11, verse 36 and 37, that's what I'm looking for. And others had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover of bonds and imprisonments. They were stoned, they were sawn asunder, were tempted or tested. They were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins. You say, what does that mean? That means that you had emperors like Diocletian and Decius. They would take them and they would sew them up in animal skins that had bloody skins on them, and they'd let them loose in the wilderness, and they could not break open. And so the wild animals would attack them thinking that it was a bloodied goat or a bloodied sheep. That's what that's a reference to. They were destitute, they were afflicted, and they were tormented. God's people always have suffered. Don't ever get to the point where you think that suffering is not part of the Christian life. Suffering is a big part of the Christian life. And so when we are suffering, we must realize that this is not the end. The best is yet to come for the child of God. And so you've got David, and when he tries to give his sympathy, we see it's rejected. If you look with me back in our passage in chapter 10 of 2 Samuel, I want you to look at what happens in verse number 3. We see slander. And the princes, that would be the advisors, those that were maybe very good friends with Hanun. You've got these servants, these counselors, this boy's cabinet, so to speak. And they don't just come right out. They try to get him to think, you know, about this himself. I mean, he's got these ambassadors that have come from David. They've left their land. They've gone into a distant country. And he said, they said unto Hanun, their lord, thinkest thou that David doth honor thy father? In other words, his motives are questioned. And your motives are going to be questioned sometime. The thing that you've got to make sure is you've got to make sure that your motives are right. Because you see, God knows the thoughts and intents of the heart. He knows why you make certain decisions. He knows what your motivation behind the decision is. And so you've got these men that are questioning David's integrity. Doth he honor your father, that he hath sent comforters unto thee? You know what he's done? They said three things about why these ambassadors had come. The first thing was to search the city. In other words, they just want to just walk around and they want to see what this city looks like. But that's not all they want to do. They just don't want to go sightseeing. They want to spy it out. In other words, they want to see where the weak spots are. Is that tower weak? Is that tower strong? Is that gate burnable, or is that gate too strong? They're spying it out to overthrow it. In other words, they're looking around, they're looking for weakness. Why? Because they want to destroy you and take it. And that is what they basically tell this man. Well, can I tell you that it's a very important thing for young people to have good counselors? You know, that's one of the problems that when the kingdom split, you had certain kings that would listen to the young men instead of the old men. There was one king that said this. They said, the old counselor said, why don't you relieve the tax burden on the people and give them a break from the heavy taxation that your father had laid upon them? And basically, it would create some goodwill. Because let's face it, nobody wants to pay more in taxes. Now, I know that there's some billionaires out there, and they say, oh, it's okay, I wouldn't mind paying more in taxes. The problem is, they're lying. You say, how do you know that they're lying? All righty, anybody ever heard of a company called Berkshire Hathaway? All right? Anybody that know the name of the man that's the head of it? Warren Buffett. That's exactly right. At one time, I think he's probably about number 3 right now, but at one time he was number 2 behind Bill Gates. I think Bill Gates is number 2 now, and the guy Bezos from Amazon, which we give money to all the time, he's the one that is, I think, number 1 now. But Buffett is probably about number 3 in America. Can I tell you, he's been in court with the IRS for 10 years to not pay more taxes? But yet when he gets on television, he'll say this: I pay less in taxes than my secretary. And I'm thinking, you're comparing apples and oranges, buddy. You're not paying income tax, you're paying capital gains tax. She's paying an income tax rate, you're paying a capital gains rate. He doesn't get a salary, he gets dividends. And so when he makes that statement, everybody goes, wow. Can I tell you something? If he were really serious about that, all he'd have to do is write a check to the government. But yet, we don't want to pay more in taxes, and neither do they. And so you and I see this played out there, and they say, why don't you let up on the people a little bit? But the young ones say, oh, no. Let's put them more on them so that we can get more money coming in. And all of a sudden, I think the terminology was, your father whipped you with whips. We're going to do it with scorpions. And so therefore, the burden was greater and rebellion started to just seethe throughout the whole nation of Israel. And so you've got the need for great counselors if you're wise. The proverb says that there is wisdom in the multitude of counselors. Can I tell you, it is a stupid person that makes very important decisions without seeking counsel. You and I ought to be always looking for somebody that's considered to be wise. Now you say, who would that be? Well, Dr. Hodges used to say this, that if you want to learn how to grow corn, you go find a man that's got some in his corn crib. You know, there's some people, they can tell you all about how to be a millionaire. They can tell you how to do this. They can tell you how to do that. The only problem is they've never done it. I remember reading a book many years ago, and I've given it to a lot of our young people. It's called The Richest Man in Babylon. And in that book, one of the first lessons this man learned, he was saving 10% of what he was earning, and he took the money after he had had a little money in his little money bag, and he invested it with a group of people called Phoenicians. And they were going to go across the sea and they were going to buy diamonds and they would come back, they were going to sell them in Babylon and they were going to make a killing. The only problem was these men that went to the Phoenicians didn't realize that they were being sold glass instead of diamonds, and the guy lost all of his money. He said, I learned right then that I had to be careful who I invested with. And you better be careful the type of counsel that you take. You better find somebody that's got some corn in their crib. If you're buying diamonds, you better find somebody that's been in the jewelry business. And so you've got this young man. He's listening to some of his counselors. They are suspicious of David, even though Nahash had helped him many years in the past. And so what do? Look with me at verse number 4. Wherefore, Hanun took David's servants, he took his ambassadors, and shaved off the one half of their beards. Now remember this. In the East, a man's beard is his masculinity. All right? If you look at Middle Eastern pictures, you will see that a lot of those men like to have bushy beards. That's just a mark of being a man in those cultures. They took these men. Now, by the way, I do not think that these are old men. I mean young men. I think they're old men. Who is someone that's an ambassador? Someone whose temperament is good? Someone that can keep control of their emotions? Someone that is able to rationalize and logically think things through? And so you've probably got at least some middle-aged, if not elderly men that have made this trek. And if you look at ambassadors, even in our own country, you usually find somebody that's probably in their 50s or 60s or early 70s. You want to find somebody that's not going to be a hothead, and that usually comes with 20-year-olds. You just imagine if you got a 25-year-old guy here, he's got a bushy beard, and the next thing you know, you got somebody and they're shaving half of it, and they're making him embarrassed because he's got one side bushy and one side clean. He's thinking, I'm going to get revenge, and he may start, and all of a sudden, he's going to die. And so we see that the ambassadors are humiliated. But it's not just their faces. I want you to continue reading. It says that they cut off their garments in the middle, even to their buttocks, and sent them away. What you've got is, you've got men, they don't have breeches on. All right? They wear long robes. They will have an outer tunic. They will have a belt or a girdle that would go around them. They may possibly have some type of head dressing, maybe a turban or something. And then they may have like a tallit that would be wrapped around their shoulders. But as far as underneath, they're au naturel. All right? And so what do? They shave half of their beard, leave the other half. Then they take sharp knives and they cut the back of their robes off so that their blessed assurances are showing. And so you've got these men that are now being forced to leave town. The people are jeering. They're laughing. They're being humiliated. You've got people, you know, as the Old Testament little metaphor goes, they're wagging their tongues at them. And so they're looking at each other. Their heads are down because their masculinity, and now their nakedness is showing. And so there's a shame that's there. But then I want you to see David's good side again. All right? David's good side. Look with me at verse 5. When they, the spies, told it to David, or the messengers told it to David, he sent to meet them. Who? The men who had been humiliated. And he said, this is what I want you to do. Because the men were greatly ashamed. Who wants to go into Jerusalem and everybody see your backside and look at your face, and they're going to be thinking, boy, that is just one ugly sight right there. Now, some of you go, well, that wouldn't bother me if I was trying to get back home. Well, it would be if you had to run the gauntlet to get there. Let me ask you a question. Who wants to go to the mall half-dressed? I guess malls are still in. Who wants to go out to a restaurant? You know, in an attire that looks like that, you know, you ought to be going to a swimming pool. Not anybody that's got any sense. Some of you ladies, you won't even go out of the house without putting your makeup on. I visited a lady last Saturday morning, and when I walked in the room, she went, "No!" And I said, "You're great. You're the most radiant woman that I've seen all day." She was the only one I'd seen all day. Okay? She said, "Well, you sure have a way with words." And I said, "Well, thank you, and you're great. You're good." But she was so embarrassed that I came into the hospital room, and she did not have her makeup on. And some of you ladies are exactly that same way. And so these men are ashamed. Their nakedness is exposed. Their masculinity has been besmirched. And so, what does David say to them? Tarry at Jericho. How long? Until your beards are grown, and then come home, then return. Is that not a kind thing? You know, you're my ambassadors. You guys are my guys. And I don't want people looking at you with, you know, suspicious eyes or with a jaundiced look. I want you to be whole. I want to make you whole. And so I tell you what we're going to do. I want to pay for you guys to hang out at Jericho. And that way you can let your beards grow. You can just kind of take a little time. And then after everything's back to normal, as far as the way that you look, then you come on home. I think that's a good thing. You know, one of the things that I like about the fact that he told them to hang out at Jericho, you know, Jericho has one of the greatest freshwater supplies of water in the whole country of Israel. Let me tell you when it started. It started over in 2 Kings. You've got a prophet named Elisha. And in Jericho, there's a bitter well that's there. And Elisha performs a miracle. And that well is turned from bitter to beautiful water. And to this day, they still have springs that bubble through that area. And it's called Elisha's Springs. You can go right over to that pool, and if you so chose to, you could reach down and you could get you a palm full of water. You could put a cup in it. You could put a bottle in it, and you could drink right out of Elisha's Springs in 2019, just like these men could in 1000 BC. That's beautiful. And so he gave them a good place to recover. He gave them time to recover. And all of us need that from time to time. Sometimes we just need to get away. We need to kind of recoup. And so we see that he gives them that. So we've seen David's sympathy. We've seen the slander. Let's finish up tonight with the third one, and that is the slaughter. The slaughter. Well, in verse number 6, it says, when the children of Ammon saw that they stank before David. In other words, that's a euphemistic way of saying that when the people of Ammon, when they knew what David thought about them, they looked at each other and said, well, David thinks that we have an odor like dung. Can I tell you that they were right? Because they rebuffed his kindness, they knew that David did not like that. And so it says that they stank before David, and they thought, David's coming. And so what did they do? They hired the Syrians of Beth Rehob, and they hired the Syrians of Zobah. There were 20,000 footmen, and of King Maacah, 1,000 men. King Maacah probably was a little small country because he could only give 1,000. You have 20,000 from the first two, and you've got 12,000 from the last one. And the last one is the men of Ishtob. The little prefix Ish there, it just simply means men of. So Ishtob means men of Tob. That's all that means. There were 12,000 from there. Verse number 7 says that when David heard it, he sent Joab and all the host of the mighty men. In other words, David took his soldiers. He told Joab, he said, I want you to go and I want you to fight against the people of Ammon. I know they've got some mercenaries that they have hired from Syria. And when you begin to look at all of the last several verses here, you'll notice that there are about five different, maybe six different things that you see where that there is an action and then there's a reaction. It's what people see and then what they do. The first one is the one that we just read. You've got the people in verse number 6 thinking that David says, they stink, they've shamed me, I'm coming against them. And so what do? Their reaction is, hire mercenaries. Remember this, you get what you pay for. All right? One of the problems in ancient Rome was that they began hiring mercenaries to fight their battles instead of fighting them themselves. They got soft. And so in verse number 6, we see that the Ammonites, they thought that they understood that they stunk in David's sight, and so they hired mercenaries. Look with me at verse 9. We see another person that's seeing something. And when Joab saw that the front of the battle was against him before and behind. So what do you see? Verse 8 tells you. The children of Ammon came out, put the battle in array at the entering in of the gate. So you've got Ammon, and they're at the front gate of their city. But they took the mercenaries, they took the Syrians, those of Zobah and those of Rahab and Ishtab and Maacah, they took all of them and they put them out in the field. In other words, they're in the wide open spaces, but the men of Ammon are in tight next to the wall, next to the city. So Joab, he comes in with the mighty men, and all of a sudden he sees that he has got some people in front, and now you've got a group of people that have moved in behind. And so what do you see? You see that the rest of the people, he devises a plan, and what he does is he takes part of the people of Israel, and he is going to go against the Syrians, which is the larger force. But he's got a brother named Abishai. Remember now, how did these guys get to be the leaders in this Israeli army? I tell you how. If we went back several chapters, you've got David, and what you find is, you find that David says, whoever goes up the water spout will be the leader. Joab goes up, he's the first one to the top. He's the leader. Abishai, his brother, he gets up there quick. He's another leader. And so these are the men that earned it. There's a word that every once in a while you'll hear the word meritocracy. And all that simply means is you are rewarded because you did good, you did right. And so the meritocracy kicked in with Joab and with Abishai, and now we see it coming to pass in our passage tonight. You've got Joab, and he calls his brother, and he says, look, they're in the front of us, they're in the back of us, we've got to divide. I'll take my crew, and we'll go fight against the Syrians, which is the larger group, but then you take your group, and you go against Ammon. So that's the battle plan. And he said, if it goes against me, you come and help me. And if it begins going against you, I'll come and help you. And so these two brothers, they are working this out. But I want you to notice something in verse number 12. He said, be of good courage. Let us play the men for our people and for the cities of our God. I love that little phrase, let us play the men. You know why athletes posture? You ever notice when you have two boxers and they're doing the weigh-in like the day before the fight? I mean, they're nose to nose. If this is one of their noses, the other guy's right here. You know, I mean, it's just like, I'm thinking, if that guy's got bad breath, that'd be awful. And so you've got this posturing, you know, and it says, let us play the men. In other words, if we die, let's stand on our feet dying, not bowing down. We're going to be men in this thing. And so that's what they do. But then I want you to notice, and this may be the only thing that I can think of in the life of Joab that is halfway theologically correct. All right? Joab is not, N-O-T, he is not a spiritual giant. But I want you to listen to what the man says. Be of good courage. Let us play the men for our people and for the cities of our God. Listen to this. And the Lord do that which seemeth him good. If we were saying that today, we would say, the Lord's will be done. Can I tell you that's good theology? Whatever the will of God is always good. And so the only time that I know that Joab does anything spiritual is at this point right here in chapter 10. Now I could be wrong, but I've not come across anything in my study in the last 40 years that makes me think that Joab is a spiritual man. The only thing that halfway makes me think that he might be in heaven as an Old Testament saint is the fact that he was basically in the army of Israel. And so it says in verse number 13 that Joab drew nigh, and the people that were with him, unto the battle against the Syrians, and they fled before him. So they see Joab coming. They see he's acting like a man. His men are acting like men. And these mercenaries are thinking, do we want to die for somebody that's just given us some money? And so what do? They flee. And when that happens, the dominoes start falling. When you look at verse number 14, you see another group of people that are seeing something, and they react. Just like you have the Ammonites, and they understand that they're stinking, they hire mercenaries. Joab sees what's going on. He devises a plan. Well, now in verse 14, the children of Ammon saw that the Syrians were fled. Then fled they also before Abishai and entered into the city. So in other words, they're outside of the city. Yeah, we're ready for you guys. We got our buddies over there on the wide open spaces in the plains out there. And all of a sudden they see their buddies, and all they're seeing is the backside of them. And they're going, uh-oh. Maybe we need to do the same thing. And so they turn and they go back inside and lock the door. So the reaction is they see their helpers going, and now they go. And so you've got the Ammonites, and they flee back into the city because Abishai is headed toward their door. Well, what happened? Joab returned from the children of Ammon and came to Jerusalem. Now, somebody would say, why would he do that? Why would he not just lay siege to their city? That means that you cut off their water supply, you cut off their food supply, you don't let anybody go in, you don't let anybody come out. You put a wall around them and you besiege the city. And that was the way that they did in ancient times. Well, the problem was this. The problem was with the seasons of the year. We're not going to take time to look at it tonight, but the next time we will. If you glance over at chapter 11, what does it say? It says that it came to pass after the year was expired, at the time when kings go forth to battle. You didn't battle in the wintertime. What you battle in the springtime. There were certain times when battles were more advantageous to fight. You know, if you look at any World War II footage, some of the most horrible deaths happened in freezing cold. You had things like the Battle of the Bulge, when it was just snowing and ice, and the temperatures had dropped, and you had people that were doing their best just to try to stay warm any way that they could stay warm. And you had people that were losing fingers and losing toes and losing ears and losing noses through frostbite. And it was worse with, like, the Russian army. The Nazis were having a tough time. I mean, when you fight in those types of conditions, it can get brutal. And so the reason that Joab did not pursue the Ammonites in the battle that he was in is because the time was getting away. And he would simply say, we'll come back and fight in the springtime. And so that's why he did not pursue. Verse 15 tells us, though, And possibly there's been a little bit of time that has transpired between verse 14 and 15. When the Syrians saw that they were smitten before Israel, they gathered themselves together. In other words, they began to make battle plans, and what did they do? Verse 16 simply says that there is a king named Hadarezer. And they brought out the Syrians, Hadarezer did, that they were beyond the river. They came to Helam. Helam is about 35 miles east of the Sea of Galilee. And Shobach, the captain of the host of Hadarezer, went before them. So what they did, whenever they were smitten, they went back and they started gathering more Syrians. You remember, these guys are mercenaries that are running. But now they go back and they're trying to get the regular army. And they're saying, we need to get together. We need to have a huge, huge campaign, and we need to take care of David. You know, it's amazing how when somebody gets defeated, the arrogance grows sometimes. And it comes back to bite them a second time. And that's what we see here. When I was in the 11th grade, we were playing football, and I went to a Christian school, but a few times during the year, we played public schools. We would always have two or three public schools that would be on the football schedule. And of course, anytime, you know, a Christian school plays a public school, immediately the public school thinks that, well, the Christians, they're a bunch of, you know, little pansies and, you know, and that kind of stuff. By the way, when somebody says something about a pansy, can I tell you something? Them little flowers are hardy. Those things live in the wintertime. All right? So maybe you need to say something like tough as a dandelion. All right? But we were playing, Richmond Hill. And I knew about Richmond Hill. I had a couple of cousins that attended there. Matter of fact, one of the cousins played on the ball team. And so we're playing. And that year, we beat them 52-0. I mean, it ticked them off. Here you got this little Christian school, and they beat a public school 52-0. And my cousin Woody told me, said, yeah, you guys got lucky. I'm thinking, you get beat 52-0, it wasn't luck. All right? So the next year, they're on the schedule again. They're coming back. And so Woody and I are talking before the game. He said, we got you this year. I said, really? He said, oh, yeah. He said, this year we're not drinking. Evidently, they were drinking last year when they played us. This, my senior year, we didn't beat them 52-0. We beat them 56-0. Can I tell you, after the game, their coach wanted to fight our coach? They did. The police had to keep him from attacking our coach because they got beat. Now, I've been on the receiving end a couple of those games too now. Don't think that we just always had great victories like that. I've been smoked a few times myself. But they came back from 52-0 to get beat 56-0. They just came back for more drumming. I mean, when you beat somebody that bad, it's just kind of fun. After a while, it gets embarrassing, you know? I'll tell you another story about one night. I thought about this just now. Didn't even think about it until I looked back and saw Hub. We're playing basketball over to Old Jim. And we're playing a team one night. Here we are. We're in our 30s, 40, knocking on 40. We got about five guys that night. A couple of our subs couldn't come. And we're trying to play ball. And this team that we're playing, they got a bunch of guys that are 18 to 25 years old. I mean, they're in the prime of their life. And, I mean, they're just running and gunning. 4 minutes left in the game, they're beating us by 35 points. They're running people on and off the floor. They're not even checking in at the scorer's table. I mean, they're just running them on and off. Give me the ball. Let me slam dunk it. Let me do this and all that stuff. And they're just laughing it up and getting it in our face and that kind of stuff. And all of a sudden, I guess something flipped in Hub's mind. And one of them went up And Hub went up with him and rode him right into the floor and slammed him on the floor. You know why? Nobody likes getting their nose rubbed in it. Beat me, but don't humiliate me. And these guys, they were beaten, but yet they came back for more. I mean, they came back, and what happens? Well, if you look with me at verse number 17. When you've got Hadarezer and his Syrians, they all are coming together, Shobach's the captain. They tell David this. So he gathers all of Israel together, and he passed over Jordan and came to Helam. Well, where's Helam? It's about 35 miles east of the Sea of Galilee. Now, what's taking place during this time is the river Jordan is beginning to rise. You're probably now getting into what is called the rainy season. Rainy season goes from about November to about April. From May until October, that's the dry season. They don't get much water in Israel. But yet here you have David, probably sometime in the late fall, early winter, and he hears about this great group of people that are being amassed, and he's thinking, we'll deal with that now. And so he passed over Jordan. He comes to Helam, and the Syrians set themselves in array against David and fought with him. And the Syrians, not just the mercenary group, but all of those that were cohorts, all of those that were allies with Hadarezer, all of those began to flee before Israel, and David slew the men of 700 chariots of Syrians. That meant that 1,400 men died, because you had drivers, and then you had the guys that were shooting the arrows and throwing the spears. So there's 1,400 guys that are dead because of these 700 chariots that are taken out. 40,000 horsemen are taken out, and their captain, Shobach, is also dead. And so, verse 19 is a result. You see that all of the allies of Hadarezer they're defeated, and there's a reaction to it. What is that reaction? They sue to make peace. When they saw that they were smitten before Israel, they made peace with Israel and served them. What that means is they paid tribute to them. So you now, all because one boy may have been in his 20s, but his father died, and David tried to do a kindness for his family. But because he was taking bad advice, he rebuked those ambassadors. He humiliated those ambassadors. Word got back to David. David said, okay, if you want to fight, I'll oblige you. Now, we began this chapter by seeing David and all of his kindness. We saw David and how that his compassion was on display. But you and I have been around 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel long enough to know that David is not a man to be trifled with. He's not a man to get on your bad side. But yet there was something inside of this young boy, this boy Hunan. There was something inside of him that just would not pay attention to David's kindness. Can I tell you that I see the gospel in that? Because there are people that you can share the gospel with, but they will not see it. They'll look at you and they'll say, "You mean to tell me that you believe that a God named Jesus came to this earth, was born, died, raised again, and if I would say I believe that, I could be saved?" Yeah. I believe that if the Spirit of God puts that in your soul, I believe that you can be saved. And there, some people have looked at me and they said, that's crazy. And I'm thinking, they don't get it. The natural man receives not the things of God because they are spiritually discerned. This boy was a natural man. Had the opportunity to see, and surely he had heard of the stories. His father, when he was just a little boy, and this boy was sitting on his father Nahash's knee, he probably told him stories about David. Now, son, we live over here in Ammon, but I'm going to tell you something. Over in that country of Israel, they got a boy, and when he was about 16 or 17 years old, he killed a 9.5-foot man with a slingshot. Do you know that boy? He killed a bear and a lion when he was younger than that. Do you know that every battle that he's ever gone into, he's won it? And yet, here this boy is, when he becomes the king, he listens and says, well, David, he must be trying to take my city. Well, if he had any sense, he would have known that if David wanted the city, he would have just come and taken it. He's taken everything else he wanted. But the natural man doesn't receive the things of God. Well, the next time when we get to chapter 11, things are going to take a turn for the worse with David. But tonight, we see David in a good light. David is a man that shows kindness. Now, do you have that in your heart? What can you do to show a kindness to somebody? Well, sometimes we spend time with them. Sometimes we help them out financially. Sometimes we pray for them in their presence and only when we're talking to the Lord privately. There's all kind of ways that you can show kindness. But may I say that kindness ought to be a great, great portion of the Christian life. We ought to kill them with kindness. We ought to be a gracious, kind people. And if we really walk with God, kindness will be one of the staples of our life. Let's stand together. Wow.